The Guardian.
But you know, I think about this, and what about this internet thing? Do you know anything about that?
Sure.
What the hell is that exactly?
Well, it's become a place where people are publishing information.
Right.
So everybody can have their own homepage, companies are there, the latest information. It's wild what's going on. It is the big new thing.
Yeah.
Pokemon Go, the iPhone 7, and Donald Trump. These were 2016's most searched for terms on Google, and with over a trillion searches to draw on, it's clear they reflect quite well what's on our minds. But can Google searches tell us even more about ourselves?
So now would the computer give me more than I'm getting that way?
Well, you could find other people who have the same unusual interests you do.
By pulling together huge aggregates of our search history, a form of big data, can Google reveal our deepest, darkest desires? And what can big data more broadly tell us about the human condition?
We have kind of a new way to understand people, a new way of doing social science, and people are much more honest in Google searches than they are to surveys, and they tell Google things that they might not tell to anybody else. And I think we're learning so much more about who we really are.
But I also think there's a social element that we have an appetite for looking at the world in that way. And sometimes I think that's a sign that other things have retreated. So maybe we're no longer confident talking about things in terms of politics, but we go, hey, but maybe there's a big data solution for this social problem.
So Max, at least start this, we've got the names and bios.
I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
Yeah.
To discuss all of this and more, I sat down in the studio with two of big data's biggest proponents.
Fruit and two croissants.
Seth Stevens Davidovits.
I'm Seth Stevens Davidovits. I'm a contributing op-ed writer for the New York Times and a former data scientist at Google and the author of Everybody Lies.
And Timandra Harkness.
I'm Timandra Harkness. I'm the author of Big Data, Does Size Matter? I co-present Future Proofing on BBC Radio 4. And I'm a visiting fellow at the University of Winchester Centre for Information Rights.
And where better to start than with a simple definition? Timandra, before we get into the nitty-gritty of this, take us through what big data is. How does it compare to small and medium data?
I got interested in this because I was wondering, there's a nerdy side of me that loves maths, but everyone was getting very excited about big data. And I thought, is this hype or is it something genuinely new or is it just that we have more data than we had before? And we definitely do. I mean, it's proliferating so fast that metaphors go out of date before you can broadcast them. But I think there are some other interesting things about it that mean it has huge potential. So I've managed to backronym it into data. So as well as being big, big data has dimensions. So you can put together different types of data really easily. It's collected automatically just through our everyday activities, things we normally do, generate trails of data. It has a time component because it's produced kind of in real time, which means you can also then project patterns into the future and use them to make predictions. And the processing is often done by artificial intelligence. So it's a bit more than just really powerful calculators doing really fast statistics. You've got things like neural networks that teach themselves to look for patterns that a human being wouldn't spot. So I think big data genuinely does have potential to do things we've not been able to do before by using those techniques and methods on all the information we automatically produce all the time.
And what is it in technology that's allowed big data to become so prominent? Is it computing power, the availability of these data sets, or the algorithms, all three of these things?
I think it's a mixture of those things. I think it's a mixture of the fact we do so much digitally now. We all use smartphones all the time. We do almost everything through computers. And that generates all this data by default, really. People almost have to decide not to collect it now. But you're right, it's also that things like machine learning and just more and more powerful computers do mean we can store it affordably and we can process it faster and more. It's not even more efficiently necessarily, it's in more interesting ways than ever before. But I also think there's a social element that we have an appetite for looking at the world in that way. And sometimes I think that's a sign that other things have retreated. So maybe we're no longer confident talking about things in terms of politics, but we go, hey, but maybe there's a big data solution for this social problem.
Seth, in Everybody Lies, you look at how big data can be used to try and understand human behavior, which is essentially social science. What are the previous tools that have been used, and how do they fall short?
Pretty much the only approach to knowing what people think historically for the past 80 years or so has been surveys. You just ask people, why did you do that? What are you going to do? What do you want? And a big problem here is that people lie to surveys. They try to shade the truth in ways that make themselves look good. And I think the focus of the book is that from all this data that's on the internet automatically left, particularly people's Google searches, we have kind of a new way to understand people, a new way of doing social science, and people are much more honest in Google searches than they are to surveys, and they tell Google things that they might not tell to anybody else, and I think we're learning so much more about who we really are.
But it's a different kind of data that you're collecting, isn't it? Because with a survey, you can go to someone with an idea of trying to find answers around a particular issue, whereas with Google searches, you're just hoovering up and analyzing whatever people type in. And there is a difference there that matters, right?
I think it's, in some sense, it's better because in surveys, you're limited by things you can imagine. You only ask the question. One example I talk about in the book is that the top search in India that begins "my husband wants" is "my husband wants me to breastfeed him." And I don't think anyone would think like to ask that question. Like, oh, by the way, does your husband desire this? We would have just never known that desire existed. But because people search this thing, we actually know it and know that it is apparently a common desire in India.
That's one of the things I know from even just reading the information about your book that I now wish I didn't know, but I'll never be able to unknow it.
Seth, tell us about the tools you're using to analyze all this data.
So a lot of it is there's a public tool called Google Trends, which not enough people know about. And you can see all the data is anonymous and aggregate. You can see what people are searching for in different time periods and in different places. So you can zoom in on some part of England or some part of any country, really, in any time period. You know, last Thursday, between these hours, what were people searching on this topic? And I think, you know, considering the power of the data, it's dramatically underused by businesses, by curious people, by journalists, by pretty much anyone. I'm shocked that more people aren't using it.
Do you get a sense, though, from using Google Trends of who the people are who are asking particular questions? Because one thing that concerns me about this is that how do you know who these people are who are giving you your data? Whereas at least with a questionnaire, you know who you've given it to. You might choose that you're going to give it to, I don't know, 10 to 20-year-olds, 20 to 30-year-olds who all live in a particular area, who are all poor or something like that. But with Google Trends, what granularity do you get on the people?
So you can get a city. You can't know the gender of a person. You know, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. So you don't know the gender. You don't know the age. You could zoom in on certain cities that are predominantly elderly people or younger people to get some idea of the demographic differences. But I think one of the things that also is so powerful, this now surveys, the response rates have gone way down to the point that, you know, it's such a selected group of people who even answer surveys, whereas Google searches are kind of everybody at this point. So I think, you know, even if a particular search you don't know, you do know that in general, you're capturing everybody's collective interest in this data.
Important to say that it's not everybody in a global sense. In China, Google is only the third largest search engine behind Baidu and Soso.com. And of course, not everyone in the rest of the world is on the internet. But even if this kind of data doesn't give us a global picture of human behavior, big data now has a huge array of applications, some of which Timandra describes in her book, Big Data, Does Size Matter?
I think I'm more excited about the ways that it can be used practically in things like science and industry. For example, Rolls-Royce have sensors in their aircraft engines, which feed not only the usual stuff that the pilot gets in the cockpit, like oil temperature and speed of rotation, but even really tiny details like the metallic particles in the lubricant or the patterns of vibration. And those get fed right back into their engineering center. So again, they can project the patterns and predict when something might be about to go wrong. It's like aircraft engines that previously exhibited this vibration pattern went on to fail in 10,000 air hours. And that means that they can get an engineer out to meet the engine and solve problems before they arise. And I think examples like that are what I get really excited about. But I get a bit more squeamish when it's used for people, because on the one hand, it's true, you can reveal things that we wouldn't know any other way. And we can get snapshots of populations that we couldn't get any other way, and often very quickly and in great detail. But on the other hand, I do worry that it is this rushing in of technology to fill a gap that we have. So we feel that we don't understand each other. We don't understand what makes our fellow humans tick. And so instead of actually trying to go and talk to them, we go, oh, well, let's look at the data. Now, you're right, obviously. If you ask people, hey, do you want your wife to breastfeed you? They will tend to say no, or possibly that's none of your business, but they know that would be incriminating. But I suppose what worries me is this assumption that that's the real person, that somehow the secret you that does a Google search is the real you, and the you that says, no, don't be disgusting, is somehow inauthentic. It's like if I'm in the throes of a breakup and I'm drunk and self-pitying, and at 2 a.m. I search for some obscure kind of porn, is that the real me more than the person that goes, look, that's just, I was in a bad moment and I'm moving on, and I deliberately kept that isolated from the rest of my life. So although, you know, we can learn interesting things, I think I worry that we somehow put too much weight on that data way of looking at people and not enough weight on actually asking people what they think.
I think in general, what big data can show us is that people have multiple sides. And I don't know if there's one side that's right or one side that's wrong. So another source of big data is social media data. So data from Facebook. And that's, I think, a fairly misleading view of people, because on social media, we're trying to present ourselves to our friends. So we tend to try to make ourselves look happier and more intellectual and in better marriages than we do when we're by ourselves. So one example is I compare how people speak about their husbands on social media and on Google search. So when they talk about their husbands on social media, they use the phrase, my husband is, on social media. The top ways they complete that is, my husband is the best, my best friend, adorable, amazing, and awesome. And on Google, when they're not trying to impress anyone, when they're by themselves and they're speaking about their husband, it's, my husband is a jerk, so mean, obnoxious, annoying. Now, I would take Tamadra's point that I don't think that you say, okay, Google's that's the right view of a marriage, and that there's nothing to, you know, the best friends. You know, marriages have different parts, and sometimes you think your husband's amazing and sometimes you think your husband's a jerk. But I do think that it can round out the picture a little more. When you have enough data sets, you can kind of say, okay, like, it's interesting that people do have these multiple sides, and we can see that a little more, whereas previously, relying on what people have told us, we've gotten a very one-sided view of people and haven't really seen the complexity in people.
There are certainly times when big data can encroach on sensitive areas of our lives. Plenty of people have made their concerns clear, and Tamandra is one of them.
Oh, definitely. And I think particularly when we take like population-wide insights from big data and try and apply them to individuals, and especially predictively. I mean, I know that in the States, you're much more advanced than we are here in using that kind of approach to predict reoffending behavior and to decide whether someone should go to jail or not, or get parole or not. And I find that very worrying, because it contravenes natural justice, the desire of each of us to be judged for ourselves, and for a judge to take responsibility for saying, well, I think you, Ian, are going to reoffend, and so I'm going to keep you in prison or not, and then be answerable for that. I think those kinds of things are very worrying. And, you know, and on a less kind of dramatic level, things like using those algorithms to hire people or not to hire people, when really they're going on past data, they're going on a profile of somebody who looked like a good employee before. Well, what did they look like? But if you look back at the histories of companies, they will be a certain type of person. We're mostly trying to get away from that narrow type of person. So, yeah, I think using big data to try and make predictions about individuals is is very worrying. I was wondering, actually, whether you felt that as we get more aware of how Google is using information about us to build up a profile of us for whatever purposes, for selling us things usually, whether people will get less truthful in their searches.
So the data I use, I want to emphasize, is all anonymous and aggregate. So I think if anything, people should be very comfortable because they're doing a favor to science. If you tell all your true thoughts, you're helping science along. And I think I don't think there are privacy worries from the type of stuff I'm talking about, because it is just saying who we are. It's not saying who you are or who, you know, I don't know anything about any particular Indian man. I know Indian men in general, right? So
I didn't mean you because as you say, you look at the massive data sets. Yeah. But obviously the reason why Google has those searches is because they want to look at each of us and say, Timandra was buying cheap red wine and doing self-pitying Google searches at 2 a.m. Therefore, you know, she's a prime target for whatever we try and sell to people.
Chocolate.
Exactly. Yeah, that kind of thing.
I think it's a concern. So after Edward Snowden released how much information companies were giving to the government, someone did an academic study where they showed how Google searches were changed after that. And they did see a drop in personal or sensitive searches. So people did get concerned. Actually, the favorite part of that paper, they had to categorize what's an embarrassing search that people might not want to make when they released it. And they like gave it to people on Mechanical Turk to rank, like, how embarrassing is this search, like a whole list of searches. And one of the most embarrassing searches, according to people, was Nickelback. And you see that after Snowden dropped, like, there was a drop in, like, child porn and, like, murder, but also, like, Nickelback. Like, people are like, I don't want the government knowing that I'm searching for Nickelback. So definitely it could be that that in the future we're going to see, you know, like, I don't think it's inevitable that forever people are going to be very comfortable sharing all their secrets with Google. I hope it keeps that way, because from the social science perspective, I think it's so amazing how much we can learn if people continue to be so honest on this data set using the anonymous and aggregate data. But, you know, if the government does weird things, or, you know, and we learn about that, it may change.
Despite its shortcomings, the power of Google search seems poised to have a major impact on social science. What it can reveal about people's thoughts is all too plain to see, and no more so than in the 2016 US presidential election.
The single highest predictor of support for Trump was the geographies that made these racist searches in the highest number. So clearly it was driving a lot of support, even if people weren't saying it.
After the break, we'll also ask whether big data can ever truly capture the complexity of each and every one of us.
You don't actually get the subjective experience of the person who is thinking and feeling those things. And I think big data is much the same. It's very good, all this stuff from the outside, but it doesn't capture the subjective experience of being me.
We'll be right back.
But Theresa May will, in her speech, yes, want to focus on the European Union and indeed on Brexit. She will say that Brexit means breakfast, Brexit, and that...
Before we kick off again, I wanted to point you in the direction of another podcast here at The Guardian. It's called Brexit Means, and as the name would suggest, attempts to finally find out what exactly Brexit does mean. Apart from, of course, Brexit.
As a party, we need to unite around a message for the country to help secure a future for post-Brexit... Post-Brexit reality.
So if you feel like delving into the nitty-gritty of Britain's exit from the EU, make sure to join John Henley and his experts on The Guardian's Brexit Means. To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Brexit Means on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample.
Internet is that massive computer network, the one that's becoming really big now.
Before the break, we heard from the author of Big Data, Does Size Matter? Timandra Harkness, about the potential pitfalls of applying big data to humans. Do your internet searches really reveal much about you? And if it does, is it the real you?
I think one day I'll get one of these deals, but I, you know, I've played with them, and then you type it in, and then you get the thing, that little arrow. Is that the arrow?
You bet.
This is something former Google data scientist Seth Stevens-Davidovitz, who we also heard from before the break, explores in more detail in his new book, Everybody Lies, which touches on the 2016 U.S. presidential election.
So one of the things I started this whole Google research with is racism. That's an area, if you ask somebody, are you racist? Like in the United States, and I imagine UK as well, the answer to that question everyone knows is no. Like in 2017, no, you're not supposed to say you're racist. And I was shocked by the how many people are making racist searches, which tend to be for jokes mocking a group. Usually, I think in the United States and the UK as well, it tends to be black people are the target frequently of these jokes. And you basically see that in these parts of the country, in this previous election, there's been the question, did racism help fuel Trump? Because he said some very, very nasty things about black people in the primary. And you see that was the single highest predictor of support for Trump was the geographies that made these racist searches in the highest number. So clearly it was driving a lot of support, even if people weren't saying it. I think another thing you can use this data for is if you ask people in elections, in modern elections, you kind of know who someone's going to support frequently, but you don't know if they're going to turn out to vote. That's kind of the big thing in elections, who's going to actually come out to vote. And you can't really rely on surveys here because people love saying they're going to vote. They don't like saying they're not going to vote. But you can actually see in the weeks leading up to an election, are people searching how to vote, where to vote, polling places? If they're doing that, it's highly predictive that they're going to actually vote. So in this previous American election, in places with big African-American communities in these cities, searches for voting were way down. And this is one of the reasons Hillary Clinton did worse than the poll suggested, because African-American turnout was much lower than anybody expected. So the clues were there all along in the Google searches.
Tamandra raised this point about Google collecting data on us that will give us a very rich picture of our personalities and so on. And what you've been talking about, there are different areas where you can tell people are making more racist searches than in other areas. Couldn't this data be pulled together to allow companies to target people ahead of voting, to say, okay, these people look like they're going to be receptive to this particular message or that particular message, or this group look like they're genuinely on the fence and we might be able to hit them with this kind of idea?
Yeah, so the company Cambridge Analytics famously did this in Trump's campaign. They use more Facebook data because I think Facebook's more about the individual level targeting rather than the area level stuff because, you know, it's real identity. So they were trying to use, okay, this is the things we know about a person. These are the things we know about a person from all their Facebook profiles. Here's what message may work for them. I think it's a little overblown how successful that was. You know, it sounds really, really creepy that they're reading your mind and changing your behavior based on that. I don't think that quite is as powerful as they claim it is. But I think targeting, individual level targeting, is powerful for companies and political campaigns.
Yes, I think it's been used, I mean, certainly ever since the Obama campaigns and all the campaigns in this country. All the campaigns have used big data techniques to identify who it is they need to swing or to persuade to turn out and what messages they're most likely to be receptive to using Facebook and Google. I'm like you. I think it is overblown. And I thought it was quite interesting that here there was a big, you know, there was a lot of worry about Cambridge Analytica specifically and had they been funded and swung the results of these votes. And then we had a surprise general election result here, which nobody really foresaw. And that was a bit like, well, okay, so maybe nobody, however much big data they have, nobody actually can predict and control what's going on. But I do think it's worrying in some ways because it's reducing politics to a marketing campaign and going, we have our target groups and we're going to pick a message that hits them. And rather than saying, here's our program, here are our principles, come and support us as a cause, as a movement.
So all in all, a bit dire then. But is it all that bad? Okay. Seth, for one, thinks not. He believes this kind of big data-driven social science is poised to improve our lives. But how might this really happen?
I talk a lot about A-B testing, which is this experiment, rapid experimentation. Companies have used a lot of it. It's very, very powerful. So anytime you go through the internet now, and this is a little creepy, you're like a lab rat. You're part of 1,000 experiments. Facebook's running experiments. Google's running experiments. The Guardian probably is running experiments. I don't know. Just about every company all the time is doing little tests to see what gets you to click more. So they may change the headline on two stories and say, okay, here's a control group, here's a treatment group, who gets you to click more? We're going to change the font on our website. Which one gets people to click more? They're doing this all the time. And that's not necessarily the best use of big data, but you can use this same strategy in other areas. So one company is called Jawbone. It makes wearable devices. It knows how much people sleep every night based on their movements during the night. And they started doing A-B testing to try to get people to sleep more. So they'd give people different messages, different reminders. You may want to try going to sleep at 11:30, or you may want to try going to sleep at midnight. You might want to go to sleep at 11. And they try all these messages, and then they test. They do A-B tests. They put some people in a treatment group, some people in a control group, and they say, okay, which message is going to maximize how much sleep people get? And that's a great use because people need more sleep. And just by doing these massive experiments, which are really easy to do in the digital world, they can basically limit sleep deprivation. So I think that's one powerful use of this data for good.
Do people know that they're part of this experiment when they buy their wearable? Because to me, that sounds absolutely horrific. I have to say that I'm being experimented on by a company that decides how much I need to sleep. But then maybe I'm not the sort of person that has a wearable.
I don't know if they're informed that they're part of experiments. I think people are a little bit irrationally creeped out by experimentation because they like to have control over their lives. But we don't really have that much control over our lives. Random things are always happening to us that are outside our control. So I think a little message is not as creepy to me as it is to other people, but I know that some people do find it creepy.
I think it depends who's experimenting on me and for what reason. If people are experimenting on me to try and change my behavior, then I like to at least have had a conversation about why are they trying to change my behavior and what are they trying to change it to?
I agree. I think A-B testing raises a lot of ethical questions. So one of the reasons the internet is so addictive, which I talk about in the book, is because A-B testing is so powerful. So companies are just constantly doing these tests and which finds which one gets people to go on the site more and then just keeping the winners. So, you know, winner, 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 and eventually you have sites that people can't leave. And that's not necessarily good with people. I think the sleep example is something that could be good, or, you know, health examples could be good, but there are definitely use cases that are not so great.
Whether we like it or not, then, it seems big data is set to play an even greater role in our lives. And this may be no bad thing. It's how the data are used that matters. The million-dollar question is whether big data can ever truly capture what it means to be human.
I think that big data is very good at this multidimensional thing. And I may not like the fact that Google has this multidimensional characterization of what I'm supposedly like, but it certainly has brought together the words I use in my emails and what I search for and what places I look for on their maps and all that kind of thing. But all of that is from the outside. I always think it's like, you know, you can look at my brain scan and you can see which bits have greater blood flow, which bits have less blood flow, but you can't actually know the thought processes that are going on. And however good those scans get at saying, actually, we can match your patterns when you look at certain images or certain feelings, you don't actually get the subjective experience of the person who is thinking and feeling those things. And I think big data is much the same. It's very good, all this stuff from the outside, but it doesn't capture the subjective experience of being me.
But not everyone agrees.
I think it captures it pretty well. I think that I take the subjective experience critique, but I think asking people their subjective experience isn't necessarily going to capture it because people will mislead you in that situation. So I think I would say that big data, even if it's not perfect, is far better than anything we've ever had at understanding who people really are. And I think Google knows me better than probably anybody else.
Special thanks this week to Tamandra Harkness and Seth Stevens-Davidovitz. If If you want to find out more, we'll include links to both their wonderful books in the episode's description on the Guardian website. I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.